Nailed it.
Nailed it.
All right.
What's up?
So, welcome to episode 39 of the Spread Aviation Podcast. Did you forget it was 39?
No. It's like,
okay, good.
We're almost over the hill. We're going to start, we're going to hit 40 and we're going to be like, ah, man, it's all downhill from here.
Oh, well.
I'm kidding.
Hopefully not. Hopefully it's a climb or a...
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's see. So, yeah, it's May 28th of 2020. And this has been a crazy year. You agree, right, Matt?
I agree. I also... I'm questioning why you said the date, because when this episode is released on August 3rd, because it takes me 2 months to get to it, people are going to be like, May what? No, sorry. Keep going.
I know. But the whole reason is because something very important happened on May 28th of 1987. Do you happen to know what happened on that particular day in 1987 when we were not quite 4 years old yet?
The only thing I can think of is the Challenger.
That was even earlier. I think that was 86.
Hmm.
I think that was 86. I'd have to look that up. But no, May 28th, 1987, Matthias Rust landed a Cessna 172 in Kremlin Square in Soviet Russia.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I've read that story.
So this guy took off. I think he was from Norway. And he flew this thing, landed at some point, got some gas, or no, he's from Finland. I don't know the difference, honestly, between Finland and Norway. Flew from Finland to Moscow.
Finland is to the east of Norway, but they're about the same size. So
okay.
Yeah.
He landed at Helsinki to refuel and then said he was going to take off and go to Stockholm. And turned towards Stockholm, but as soon as he left the airspace, he then turned to the east and started heading towards Moscow. And this alerted all kinds of air traffic control, like warning, hey, what's going on? This dude was going this way, now we've lost him, or we started going this way. And they sent out a Finnish border guard, a boat, went out to try and find him, and they discovered an oil patch in the water, and so they sent a diver down, but they didn't find anything. He crossed the Baltic coastline over Estonia, and at 2:30 p.m., he appeared on Soviet air defense radar and failed to comply with their identification friend or foe signal, IFF, which nowadays is given by our transponder automatically. Back then, it may not have been automatic. He may have had to... may have had to hit the reply button. And so then they assigned, the controller then assigned a hostile code to his aircraft, alerting the entire Soviet air defense at the height of the Cold War that this guy was a hostile coming to attack their country. Can you imagine what that would be like?
Wow.
20 to 30 minutes later, some intercept pilots saw him, but they couldn't identify the Cessna 172 against other Russian-built general aviation aircraft,
right.
Specifically a Yak-12, and so they couldn't get permission to engage him. So they wanted to shoot him down, but the controllers in Soviet Russia and the military, you didn't have the decision to make a decision. You didn't have the ability to make a decision. You were told what to do by the controllers. After that, they lost sight of him, and they think that he may have landed again because he changed clothes. Not quite sure why he would have changed clothes, but they think that he did land again because almost 5 hours later at 7 p.m., and I'm not sure if there was a time zone change here. I imagine there was at least one, but at 7 p.m. local time, he showed up over top of Moscow Square. And it had originally decided that he was going to land at the Kremlin, but then he would have been behind all the walls and nobody would have seen him.
Right.
So then he circled around and chose Red Square as a place to land. And just luckily, some trolley wires that used to power the trolleys had been removed that morning. So there wasn't an obstruction for him to have to avoid to put this thing down in the square. And there's a great photo of this 172 with the flaps down in like the flare, and there's just people all around. Yeah, it's amazing. But He ended up, let's see, that was May. He ended up being sentenced to 4 years in a labor camp. But Gorbachev and who was it? Who was the president at the time? Was it, wasn't Reagan. Was it Reagan? I think it was Reagan. Yeah, it was Gorbachev and Reagan, because it was 87. Mm-hmm. Gorbachev and Reagan met, and they decided to disarm all of the medium-range, intermediate-range nuclear missiles. And Gorbachev was like, and we'll let this guy go as a goodwill signal to the West. And they released him in August of that year. So he spent a couple of months. He didn't go to the labor camp. They ended up putting him in a prison. But it's said that because this guy in a Cessna 172 penetrated the strongest air defense, more than likely in the world, that was the Soviet-Russian air defense system, this killed all the confidence that the public had and the government had in the military leadership. So Gorbachev was able to fire all of these generals that had opposed him and his bid for power, because they were still kind of a parliament and it was a Politburo. But Gorbachev was really the guy that was in charge, and he had to fight all these guys. So he was able to get rid of them. He was able to de-escalate. He was able to denuclearize. And this was one of the events that signaled the fall of communist Russia. And it's all because of this guy in a 172. Who would have thought? All on May 28th, 1987.
Wow. Do you know what model it was? 172?
I can't quite tell by looking at the photo. It's either a P or an N model.
Wow.
There's nothing that would really distinguish it between those two in this photo. I would almost assume it was a P model, just by it only looks like there's 30 degrees of flaps and not 40 in the N models. Most of them had 40 degrees of flaps. So I don't know.
The 40 degree flap ones, those are the ones where you have to worry about the tail stall, right?
That's more like the H models, because those didn't have the dorsal, but the N did have the rudder authority to get to side slip angles where you could start to get that tail stall burble if you were at 40 degrees of flaps in just the right conditions. But I mean, you could, but it wasn't as big a problem as like the H model and before.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And that's the one scenario where where you stall and you have to apply back pressure to get out of it, right?
Yeah. And you'll feel that, because it's not the wing stalling, it's the tail stalling. And that low pressure moves to the hinge where the elevator meets the horizontal stab, and that low pressure, it's a vacuum, and it sucks the elevator to the nose down position, and it would actually yank the yoke out of your hands. You'd feel it, and it'd slam up against the dash, and you'd have to grab it and pull it back in order to get that airflow reattached. And it took a good amount of force, anywhere from 40 to 80 to 120 pounds, depending on the size of the aircraft and the size of the horizontal stabilizers and elevators.
Got it. Well, it's funny, like, leave it to us to play the Wikipedia game on an episode of Spread Aviation where you start at, you know, red square and you end at tail stall. Just like
we'll get there.
The 5, 6, 7 clicks, and you eventually get to a completely different topic. So actually, going back to the story you were talking about, was he expecting the wires to be, the overhead wires to be in red square, or did he know that they had been removed?
There's nothing in this story that I've read that indicates that he knew that they were there, that he knew that there was going to be maintenance performed on them or anything. And it probably would have been one of those things where he got there and was surprised by their presence and may have had to make alternate plans. If he had been flying for as long as the time frames of this story say, he definitely didn't have a whole lot of gas on board when he got there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So this was a one-way trip. Like, he knew he wasn't going home.
Right, especially once he got to a certain point, he was unable to turn around and would have had to keep moving forward anyway.
Yeah.
Rob, we've been posting some stuff on social media, the hand drawings that have kind of gotten a lot of attention, and I think it's kind of really good for the mission of Spread Aviation, which is, you know, to your point, kind of making better pilots, right, and improving safety in general aviation. What are some of the things that you've learned from some of the comments you've received? Have you learned anything you didn't know about what people may not realize they don't know?
Well, it's pretty interesting that people are very committed to what they don't know. And they're thankfully, I guess, willing to share that they don't know something. Like, they're willing to actually talk and communicate that. But they're very, very adamant in their wrongitude. I don't know. And it's not necessarily their fault. I place the blame for pilots having misconceptions on things on their previous flight instructor. And that may even have to go all the way back to their previous flight instructor and their previous flight instructor and their previous flight instructor, because none of this is natural. None of this is something that we are born knowing how to do, or have an opportunity to do in our natural lives. This is very much a skill that we go out and we seek the advice of people who are supposed to be professionals, and we only know what we've been taught or what we've read. It's actually very rare to have someone who has done independent research or really paid attention or done my favorite thing, and that's be a four-year-old and ask why. And if the answer to why is because I said so, well, you need to dig deeper than that. And a great answer to why that a CFI can give if they don't actually know the why is, no, I don't know. Let's find out together. And that way two people learn, and they can then continue to spread better information to the other people that they meet. And on the flight instruction side, I'd prefer to fix a flight instructor because they're going to fix their next 10 students. So I fixed one, he fixes 10, and those next 10, if they become flight instructors, they fix 100 between them. Okay, so that's one of those places where I see people get very adamant and eager to defend their knowledge because it came from that authority figure. And I'm very pleased that people do respect their flight instructors enough to go to bat as much as they have on some of this stuff. However, we also need to be open-minded, and if someone is presenting new information as to the how and the why, we need to go, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Or the thing that I thought I knew, well, when it gets scrutinized, it doesn't really hold up anymore. It doesn't hold water. And another side of that coin is it's amazing how safe we can be even with impartial information or incorrect information. And that's good. That's a product of safe airplanes and good standards that are set forth by the FAA and recurrent training and things like that. But we're always learning. There's always more to learn. There's always more to do. And that's part of the purpose of some of these, is to not only evaluate where the general pilot population is, but also an opportunity for people to ask why and to get more answers, better answers to that.
Well, that's a lot, but I think it's very well spoken, Rob. I think you made a good point. And you know, I think the analogy that I'm a big fan of is, you know, you give a man a fish and you feed him for one day, but you teach a man to fish and you feed him for life, right? I think that's the analogy. And, and you know, in this case, I almost like it better, which is just leveraging, you know, your expertise or anybody in your position's expertise. You know, if you pass your knowledge on to flight instructors who, you know, to a point you've made in the past, many of them are incredibly experienced. There just may be some knowledge gaps here and there. You fill those knowledge gaps, and then they have the exponential ability to pass that knowledge, you know, onto 10, 20, 30, 50, 100, 200 people. So it allows the information you're trying to spread as both Rob and as Spread Aviation to exponentially reach as many pilots as possible.
Yeah.
I really like the why, the four-year-old why comments you make, because, and if Peter's listening, he's going to smile when he hears this, but, you know, as you know, I'm a big fan of five whys. It has saved me a number of times. It's something I learned maybe 15 years ago, and I use it in my life. I use it.
Tell me about five whys.
Every time I fail. So five whys is actually the opposite of what, yeah, it's similar, but it's kind of the opposite of what you're saying. It's something happened, or this is the way something is. Why is it that way? Well, because this. Why is it that way? Because this. Five whys is the other way around. You start at the end and you have a failure, right? So let's say that I went for a run today and my goal was to get you know, a 5K in under 30 minutes, right? This is a simple example that I didn't plan for, and it's probably going to be a bad one. But I wanted to run a 5K in under 30 minutes. It takes me 40 minutes to run the 5K. So I failed at completing my goal. So then I ask, why did it take me 40 minutes to run a 5K? I say, why? Well, obviously the reason is that I was not fast enough to make it in under 30 minutes. Okay. Well, if I wasn't fast enough, why is that? Well, maybe because I haven't been training enough. Okay. Why haven't I been training enough? Oh, because I've been really busy with work. Okay. Well, why are you busy with work? Because, you know, I have to pay my bills. Why do you have to pay your bills? Because they're late. Oh man. The reason I'm not, you know, making a 5K in under 30 minutes is because my bills are late. My bills are not actually late, but this is an example. And the thing is, you can, in that kind of scenario, you can actually have multiple branches. So you start with one end and it's like a spider web going backwards of just so many different possible reasons why. So, you know, that kind of failure is probably a bad example, but a five whys, as it applies to the aviation industry, could be that, you know, you had a gear up landing, right? Like a retrospective for a gear up landing. I would love to do five whys on those. And I assume there are people out there that do those. They do retrospectives, right?
Well, I've had one in the sim. We could talk about that.
Yeah. You know? So let's talk about it. But yeah, five whys to me, are very important to track down the root reason why something is. And it's almost just, if you're familiar with retrospectives, right? It's a simpler version in my mind of a retrospective, because you're simply asking the question why five times. That's it. And five times should be enough to get to the root cause or multiple root causes of the problem that you encountered. And I think the biggest thing about it is that most people say, you know, why did I have a gear up landing? I forgot to put the gear down, right? And they might stop there. They might say, I forgot to put the gear down. That's the cause. Well, yes, that's the cause. But when you're doing an actual five whys, you go past that. Why did you forget? Because you didn't have enough practice.
Because I didn't run my normal checklist.
Because I didn't run my normal checklist. Right. Why didn't you run your normal checklist? And you keep going
back. Because I was distracted because we were doing an emergency procedure and I was spiraling down over the field.
Exactly. Things like that. Oh, wait, this is your actual example.
I'm actually answering the question.
Oh,
yeah. And
yeah.
I was under stress.
Yeah. So again, like the 4 year old, you know, I'm a big fan of explain it like I'm five, but explain it like I'm four. Cool. The 4 year old questions of why, I agree with you is really, really important in aviation. And then also like applying a good retrospective when things go wrong and asking those same questions backwards, to get to the root cause of a problem, is also very, very important.
Absolutely. And the other side is you have to be honest. Like you can't get into that delusional answer of it's not my fault or whatever.
No ego.
Yeah. It may be someone else's influence on your decision making, but still, if it comes down to an action you did not take or did take, then, you know, that's at some point it is going to be on you. So yeah, ego has to be eliminated from it.
Right. And it almost makes sense to have somebody else run the five whys. You know, so when I do retrospectives in my industry, in my day job, you know, oftentimes we'll have somebody run the five whys that may be good at retrospectives, but may have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, right? So I could have an issue that's very technical and over their head, but they're still able to ask the question why, and they're also able to determine whether or not the answer I'm giving is an honest one. And you know, you don't need to be intimately familiar with the industry in order to be a five wise moderator, at least in my opinion. And that, you know, sometimes it's just good to have somebody neutral that, you know, will hold you to being honest and hold you to not having an ego. So you get to the root cause of the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So are we moving on now? We're moving 1,000 miles an hour. Let's see, this week, in the last couple of days. Well, I'm trying to do like current events.
Well, all right. I got something to talk about until you get there.
Okay, no, I'm there, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I wanted to take a step back to the diagrams you've been posting on Instagram, because one thing that they have done that I've noticed, and again, your explanation 5 minutes ago was awesome. But one thing I've noticed is when I see them, sometimes it's very hard for me to immediately understand the answer, even though they're so simple. It's like A or B. I have to run through, you know, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, 3 minutes of just like, wait a minute. Is that correct? And one of the biggest mistakes I make And I find myself repeatedly making this mistake, and I'd be curious to know if others do as well, is around windsock direction. So I constantly, like, if I look at a windsock, so if I'm taking off like runway 29 at Hanscom, and you know, the wind is, you know, out of the east, right? I guess that would be a tailwind. The wind's out of the north. You know, I constantly have an issue where I look at the windsock and I think I might have like a crosswind, like a left crosswind, when it's actually a right crosswind, because I'm looking at the windsock not as like the direction that the wind is coming from, but as more of an arrow. Right. Yeah. You know, when I make that mistake, I have to consciously correct myself. And it's been something that I just had a really hard time getting over. And, you know, I noticed some of the comments on the social media posts that people make a response and they're like, oh, no, wait a minute. I mixed something up, got it backwards, et cetera. So what are some things in your experience that you've noticed in aviation that are very simple mistakes like that people make where it's almost such a simple answer that they constantly get it wrong? Not because they don't know it, but because they just act too quickly on assuming they're correct.
Yeah, with the windsock direction, that's actually one that we see a lot, and I even still experience myself every once in a while where you just take it at a glance and you're like, oh, the wind's coming from over there. No, it's coming from the other side. And some of that is just an interpretation error, and some of it is expectation. So you expected to see one thing that's already in your brain as almost a level of primacy. And then when you go to look for the information, you see something that looks just about right. And you go, okay, great. So like in your example where you may be thinking, okay, I've got a crosswind today. And for whatever reason in your head, you're like, it's a left crosswind. And you get out there onto runway 29 and the wind is out of 010. And you look at the windsock and it's pointed off to the left, but you just see this horizontal aspect and you're like, oh, yep, that makes sense. However, if you had gotten in your head, oh, there's a left crosswind today, and you got out there to the runway and the windsock was straight down the runway, you wouldn't have that same almost confirmation bias because it's so drastically different mm-hmm. from what you expected it to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an area where, yeah, we definitely run into those things. And Hanscom, as an airport that you flew out of for a very long time and I flew out of for a very long time, has two not quite parallel runways. It's got a runway 23 and a runway 29. And they had so many issues with pilots lining up to land on the wrong runway that the FAA now requires Bedford Tower to confirm with all pilots that they understand they're landing on 23, and they actually have, they say something like verify heading on final or something like that. I can't remember what the verbiage is, but when I came back from Canada a couple weeks ago, it was the first time I'd landed at Hanscom in years, and they said those words. I was confused by it, but I read it back, no big deal. And another pilot was brave enough, I suppose, to ask on the radio, hey, why are you doing that? And the tower controller told him, FAA says we have to do it now. Too many people are landing on the wrong one or lining up on the wrong runway.
Mm.
So that's an issue where, and I know I did it myself.
Rob, is that a scenario where people would line up on 29 when they're supposed to be using 23 simply because Hanscom almost always uses or seems to be using 29 as their default runway? Or is it really just a, like 29 and 23 are so close together, they're hard to differentiate sometimes.
If we play the 5Y game,
mm-hmm.
we'll eventually get to this noise abatement agreement between the town of what's just to the southwest of Hanscom. It's a really rich town. They got a lot of money.
I don't.
Or maybe
know.
it's to the southeast. I can't think of the name of it right now.
Okay, let's say the town next to Hanscom.
Yeah. If we play the 5Y game, we'll eventually get to a noise abatement agreement between a neighboring town to the southeast of Hanscom that says that there will be no business jet traffic. It might be Lexington. That there'll be no business jet traffic on the south side of the airport to keep noise away from this town. So all of the jets get right traffic to 29 and they go around the north side of the field. Well, the first runway you're going to come across as you're circling around to the north side of the field is runway 23. And so you're looking out the window from 4 miles out and you see a runway out there and you're like, oh, that's it. And you do your turn and it's only 60 degrees off. That's not a ton. It's not a little, but it's close enough that if you're on like a 090 and you look out at that and you're like, oh, that's a, yeah, I got to go over there.
Yeah.
You'll look at that and go, yep, I got to land on that. I got to turn to that. And then tower's got to go, hey, no, turn left, 090, keep going, go another couple miles, and then make your right base. And it's all because of this noise abatement agreement between Hanscom and the neighboring town. So,
but I assume you could have similar issues, you know, for example, Boston, runway 4 left, runway 4 right, right? Like, I assume that there's potential confusion there, no?
Parallel runways are not quite as bad. Most everybody's using the ILS anyway, so okay. they're using guidance. Even when you're on the visual, you're still loading approaches, and so you've got needle swinging and things like that. 4 left and 4 right, you'd look out and you'd see the runways, and even at night, they're colored not differently between left and right, but you would see white lights on the left and white lights on the right, and whichever one you were supposed to be on, that would be a real easy differentiation. And all the taxiways would be blue. So in the daytime, maybe you could get confused between a taxiway and a runway, cough, cough, Harrison Ford, cough, cough. But it's not so big an issue when you have parallels as when you have two runways that are very close together. And my story with it is Akron-Canton Airport used to have runways 119 and 3-2. And I was supposed to be doing right traffic for runway 19 at night solo in a Cessna 172. And I turned base and turned final, and the runway, the landing light lit up the numbers 14 instead of 19. And I went, oh, add the power, call the go around. And tower laughed at me and said, yeah, resume right traffic for 19. But I didn't verify with my heading indicator when I turned final that I was on the correct number, that I was on the correct heading for that runway, for the runway that I wanted. And if I'd have checked, I'd have seen that real quick. And so it's the same kind of thing. You see what you think you should see, and you go with that information because it's close enough. And you may be loaded up on stress. You may be trying to perform tasks and hurry and get checklists done, and miss that one little detail of, hey, just check out that heading indicator. Make sure that's right. Make sure that looks right.
All right. Yeah. I guess the only other thing I can think of from those social media posts that might apply to the situation was also just the like question you asked about what's dangerous about a right traffic versus left traffic in a certain scenario. And, you know, the answer ended up being tailwind versus headwind on base. And, I'm sure that's probably something that's just as easy to confuse as a windsock. Cause you might look at the windsock and assume you're going to have a tailwind on base and you're like, oh no, I actually have a headwind on base, which is probably a better thing. But if it's the opposite, when you assume you're going to have a headwind on base and you end up looking at the windsock incorrectly and you're going to have a tailwind on base, that can set you up for some unpleasant turn to final.
Yeah, and some of the corrective actions that people suggested, the more interesting ones were, you know, fly wider on the downwind and turn tighter on the base. But nobody really talked about increasing the descent rate, using less power and getting the airplane down a little bit quicker, and doing a continuous turn to the final. You know, so those were some of the suggestions that weren't given. And that's actually what I prefer to do. I prefer to fly my normal spacing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not having to make changes to my sight picture. Everything still looks the same as every other landing I've ever done, if I have to.
And you're not unnecessarily going further in case you lose an engine.
Right.
Yeah.
And so now I can pull the power all the way to idle a beam, start that turn, and knowing that I'm going to have a big wind corrector coming around to the final anyway, I just keep that turn coming until I see the runway. Our normal approach to landing, say when we just have a headwind down the runway, our base leg is wind corrected into the wind anyway, so we need to turn until we can see the runway in our windscreen, and then we would roll out wings level. Well, in this case, we would turn and just keep turning until we see the runway, and at that point, we would notice, oh, hey, I'm a whole lot closer, and I just keep the turn going. So I never really have a base leg at that point, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that at all, not having a base leg. You just keep the turn going and set your wind corrector.
Now, wasn't there, I was talking, I guess, I think it was to you maybe 2 years ago, and, you know, some of the proposals that they were talking about for reducing stall spin issues on base to final was potentially stopping the square off of the pattern and actually making it a continuous turn, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, Embry-Riddle had toyed with and made public that they were doing this, the continuous downwind base final. The continuous turn, which is not new technique. This goes back to at least as early as 1940s aircraft carrier operations, where they would just do this continuous turn because the nose of the F-4U Corsair was so long in front of you that if you lined up on the final, you couldn't see the aircraft carrier. So you had to be in this continuous turn until just as you crossed over top of the back of the boat, you roll out wings level, flare, and smack into the deck, and the tail hook could grab the wire. So it's not new. It's not a new technique at all. And in fact, it's what I do in the tailwheel airplanes and the extras, especially because they're so draggy with the propeller. I do it with them all the time. So them talking about doing it brings more attention to it that, hey, yeah, it's a viable thing to do. And it's like any other skill. It takes a little bit of practice in order to get it done. However, it's got its place in a high lift airplane like a Cessna 172 or a Diamond DA-40. On a normal wind day, you're going to find yourself rolling out like wind down the runway or not a tailwind on base. You're going to find yourself having to roll that turnout or having to have started from a lower pattern altitude. And that sacrifices things on glide distance. Well, you should never really in the pattern be outside of power off glide distance from the runway anyway, but it definitely is something that we could have another conversation about, because I actually prefer that technique to the 3/4 to a mile wide downwind flown to a mile and a half cross downwind to base turn. And now you're on this mile and a quarter final at 800 or 600 AGL, and there's no way that you can make it there if the engine quits, and you're dragging 1800 RPM in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that make any sense? If I lose this motor, I'm not going to make it to the airport I'm trying to land at when I was in the traffic pattern. That doesn't make any sense to me. So the argument that people have had against that is, well, there's some students that they just need the extra time to see it all. Like, okay, fair enough. Do that for the first 10 landings and tighten it up. But don't leave it there for 60 hours and ingrain it in them for the rest of their flying careers so that they have a problem in the pattern someday, unlikely, and they don't make the airport. You're not setting them up for success by doing that. And you get no correlation to the ground reference maneuvers that you flew at a half-mile radius. Well, come on, what are we doing here? So That's my rant on that.
It's a valid rant. Again, like I mentioned in the last episode, like I find all of this stuff to be so interesting, and I sit here and listen to you, and it's like the Grand Canyon. At the end of it, I'm like, well, I don't really know what else to say. It was a good rant, but you know, I feel like sometimes if I'm not saying bravo, good job, Rob, then I'm not appreciating your knowledge well enough. But no, that was a good rant and all good information.
Your problem is it's the 17th time I've said it to you.
Right. Well, yeah, but it's true. But you know what? You've repeated and it sticks. Yeah. You got any more aviation news before we go into questions?
Yeah. Aviation news. Garmin Autoland certified for general aviation aircraft. So Garmin's Autoland has received FAA certification in the G3000 flight deck in the Piper M600. And it will also be coming to the Vision Jet by Cirrus and the TBM 940. So aircraft that have the G3000 system installed may have that Autoland feature coming to them in the near future. And this is a, as far as I understand it, is an emergency an emergency use system, so it's not like you would necessarily get to your destination and be like, oh, just press the auto land. It's more like, hey, the pilot's unconscious. We don't know what we're doing. The passenger needs to press the auto land. So really awesome stuff that that this system is available and out there on these airplanes now. It's like the future is now kind of thing.
And how long do you think it'll be, Rob, before
pilots are replaced?
More no, not going there. Before more GA aircraft, like say the average trainer the student pilot is working in has like something like Autoland.
It will be once the insurance companies say that they need to have it or they're not going to insure the aircraft.
Yeah.
That's unfortunately, I think, where it's going to go. I don't think it'll be the policymakers. I don't think it'll be the government saying it needs to happen. It'll be the insurance companies. But
so once they run the numbers and realize that they're going to pay much less if the aircraft has it.
Yeah. And maybe we need to edit this part of the episode out so nobody hears it. But yeah, just so we don't give it away to the insurance companies that they need to do that. But I mean, the insurance rates this year have skyrocketed for everybody.
Yeah.
And, whether you've had an accident or not. And so, we're seeing the repercussions of some of the more recent accidents, the 737 Max, incidents the insurance companies are going to, and Boeing is just getting hammered. And so their insurance company is getting hammered and they're saying, well, we got to make it up somewhere.
Yeah. It's interesting that they treat, you know, GA aircraft, the same as some of those more complicated commercial airliners, considering that one of the biggest differences between the two, yes, they generally, you know, an airplane's an airplane to your point, but there's just so many differences between them and the amount of automation in those aircraft, is probably a huge part of the risk. If not used correctly, or if there's bugs, et cetera, I'd almost say, you know, a 737 is probably, or should be more likely to have similar insurance to something that I might carry at my technical consulting company in case one of the programmers working with me on a project, ends up making a mistake or introducing a bug or, you know, accidentally wiping out a client's data, something like that. Right. Versus a pilot error.
Yeah. Hopefully there's no loss of life with what you're doing on the software. Yeah,
no,
side.
It's true. It's true.
And, hopefully there's no loss of life with what we're doing on the aviation side either.
Yeah. Yeah. How long do you think it'll be before, some of the GA aircraft have like what the SR-22 has with regards to the parachute feature? Or do you think that that will just always be a weight issue and, you know, it's always going to be a weight issue?
Yeah, we're getting repetitive now. It'll always be a weight issue. There are systems that are light enough to go on light sport aircraft, but they also don't need to carry. They don't need to hold as much as say something that would go on a TBM 900. If Elon Musk ever builds, I'm sorry, if Dale Clapmeyer ever builds an airliner, it will have a ballistic recovery system. And which will probably not be one shoot, but will be multiple shoots. And
Elon Musk ever builds an airliner, it will have a ballistic recovery system. I'm sure you watched the attempted launch yesterday of Dragon and Falcon.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And we'll watch it on Saturday when it goes. And this podcast will have, congratulations to everybody. Or, oh, gee, it's a darn shame that didn't happen because we're recording it before it's happened.
Yeah.
The shoot has to be able to carry the load and it has to be able to take those opening forces and everything. And the G6 SR-20, the generation 6 SR-20 has a max gross weight of 3,150 pounds. And so that parachute has to be able to take that in whatever its operating envelope is, because there is a limit to what it can do.
Yeah.
Where its operating speeds are. But they have 100% save rate for all of the deployments that were inside the operating limits of the parachute, that were inside that envelope. So that's good. There was,
and I assume that's a weight. That means operating limits would be that it's the aircraft is not overweight and also that it's deployed at a high enough altitude, right?
Yeah. Weight, airspeed, and altitude. So they got to be going fast enough, but not too fast. They got to be, high enough off the ground that the thing has time to open. And even then, there's also a velocity vector component to it, which, you know, I'm not sure that they talk about. I'm not a Cirrus expert by any means. But like ejection seats, unfortunately, since you and I last recorded, the Canadian Snowbirds had a crash where they lost their public affairs officer. And that was in an aircraft that had ejection seats that they were both activated, but it was at too low of an altitude with a downward velocity vector. So the rocket on the seat has to overcome that downward velocity as well in order to get you to a height that you can have a successful deployment of the parachute and save your life. Well, the same thing with the caps. I think the caps on the one on the SR-20 goes active at either 400 or 600 feet. I think it's 400. It doesn't go active, like it's just now available to you, but that's a VY climb. Okay. So you rotate it off the ground, you're pitching for VY, you're accelerating upwards. And if you lose the motor right there and you pull the caps, that's going to save you. The chute is going to deploy. But if you're at 400 AGL, and 150 knots with vertical, 150 knot vertical velocity down, that's not inside where the parachute could actually have time to work. That's not enough room.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a consideration that needs to be had. And there was a recent Cirrus crash where they did have caps deployment, but they were too low, or velocity vector was too great towards the ground and they weren't high enough for the caps to save them.
And just, now, for our listeners, yeah. can you explain the velocity vector?
Yeah, it's the direction of your travel. You know, you're driving down the car at 20, you're driving down the road in your car at 55 miles an hour. You can't make an immediate left-hand turn at 55. You got to slow down. You got to change that velocity vector to give the tires any chance of grabbing the road and actually making that turn. So you got to slow from 55 to 15 or 10, mm-hmm. make the turn, and then you can accelerate again.
Well, now, is there any overlap between velocity vector and, or any relation to velocity vector and relative wind?
Yeah, absolutely. They're equal and opposite. So
cool.
Velocity vector of 10 degrees down would have a relative wind of 10 degrees up.
Got it.
They're opposite directions.
Cool.
And same magnitude.
So velocity vector and flight path are the same.
Yes.
Cool.
Yep.
So
as far as every aircraft having them, the limit comes down to weight. We had a client at Executive Flyers back in 2015 purchase a brand new 172S model and had us install a BRS chute in it. And it basically made that aircraft a two-person aircraft. You couldn't take more than two people and gas. It just wasn't going to happen. And I think it was even like, I think it was so close that, with full gas, you could take two people and like 10 pounds of bags. That was it. And the thing took up pretty much all of your cargo compartment.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
He ended up selling that airplane and bought a Cirrus.
Yeah. And I assume once you put something like that in, you can't really pull it out, right?
Not really. It's, and you could, but the cost of doing it would outweigh.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah.
How about some questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, we got a couple here. So, question number one is, how do you think commercial pilots, and this is an actual question that somebody's asked. I think it's a good question. How do you think commercial pilots are thinking differently, based on the fact that they only have like 5 or 10 people on their aircraft now versus a full aircraft of 100+ people?
That's a great question. They're probably surprised at how awesome their airplanes perform when they're that light. The airlines aren't loading more fuel on board. They're putting as much gas as they need to get there, plus their reserve, and whatever that is. So like they're actually taking the lightest aircraft that they could flying, and they're rocket ships when they're that lightly loaded. Even the Cessna 172 with 10 gallons of gas on board and just me was a completely different handling aircraft.
Yeah. Anything else they're thinking of just from a, communication standpoint or weight and balance, things like that?
We did have a weight and balance issue in the 321 where they wanted people more spread out. It was, I mean, they said it was for weight and balance. I can't imagine it was for COVID-19 because we were already really spread out, but there were only 9 of us on the flight. But they said, hey, we need some people to go to the back. And I'm sorry, ma'am. Like, there was a 120-pound lady that volunteered, and they're like, no, I'm sorry, we really need the gentleman to go, because he was a bigger dude. And yep. So they needed to change that. At least that's what they told us. So,
and do you really
I have no idea
that,
if that's
do you really think it was a major issue? I mean, would they, like, potentially not be able to recover from a stall because of that, or not be able to get off the ground because of that? Or do you think it's probably, like, they probably would have been okay? I mean, you're talking about a couple hundred-pound difference, right? So...
Yeah, but it's a couple hundred pounds of a very large datum, a very large moment arm.
Mm.
And so, yeah, sure, it totally could.
Interesting.
If all 9 of us ran to the back of the airplane and then ran to the front of the airplane and then ran to the back again, we'd be able to manipulate that aircraft.
Interesting.
The trim system and the flight computer would take care of that pretty quickly, but we would be able to have an effect, especially on an aircraft that light.
So you're telling me that if everybody in the back of an aircraft, let's say a full A321, everybody in the last 10 rows got up at the same time and all moved to the first class section all at the same time, that trim system is running a little bit at least.
I'm going to say there it's going to run a tiny bit.
Yeah.
But if you only had 10 people on board an A321 as opposed to a full flight
of
the last 10 people, you would have a bigger change because the delta is tighter. The difference is tighter between the 10 people in the unloaded jet and the 10 people in the fully loaded jet.
Yeah, so I gotcha.
Because you're talking a difference of, like, what's the average person is 170 or 180 pounds, according to the airline. So now you've got an aircraft that can hold 100 people. So let's see, that's 180, 1,800, 18,000 pounds difference between the two aircraft, between the two scenarios.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. You know,
that's a significant change. That's a significant change in CG and how much movement you can get there.
Hmm. It's interesting. I've never thought about that. You've got, like, almost an empty aircraft. If you've got 10 people that all get up and go to the front at the same time to ask a question or whatever, that trim wheel is going to be running and nobody knows any different except the pilots, but that's interesting.
Yeah. And because of the way the atmosphere works, the trim wheel moves, the pilots probably wouldn't even notice anyway, because it does that all the time.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, cool. Second question. This is actually a really interesting one.
If you're an airline pilot and you want to weigh in on that, send us an email. Hello at spreadaviation.com.
Pun intended, weigh in. Weigh in. So this is actually, I'm going to ask it in long form because it was a conversation that I saw. It's not necessarily somebody actually asking a question, but the conversation was around, somebody turning base to final and essentially coming out lined up with the runway, but in a crab. So the nose pointed off to the left a certain amount, or the nose pointed off to the right. And people were debating, at what point do you, you know, apply rudder correction and aileron correction, align your nose up with the runway. Do you want to do it essentially right away? So as soon as you notice that that you're in a crab, even if you're still 20 seconds away, 30 seconds away from touching down, do you basically go into a slip immediately to straighten up the nose and apply the correction, in the control surfaces? Or do you wait until 5 seconds until touchdown? Like, is there a best practice? It seems like there are some pilots that like to hang out in a crab a little longer than others. We always talk about, like, you know, kick the rudder over, forget the slip. Like, you're people that do that. But I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are, Rob, on, like, best practice around that.
My answer on this has changed over the years. Most definitely. And here's my definitive answer for once and for all. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
It depends.
All right. Well, this was episode 39 of the Spread Aviation Podcast.
No. It depends on a lot of different things, but one of the main ones is you need to know your aircraft systems. In a Cessna 172, where the fuel tanks feed into both at the same time, into the gascalator and then into the engine, I don't have any problems or have any concerns about unporting the gas. So the tank, the pickup's sucking air, because the engine doesn't run on air alone.
Yep.
So in a Cessna with a both fuel selector or an aircraft with a both fuel selector, I'll do it earlier and I'll feel out what it needs for that slip in order to put the airplane down in a nice crosswind. And I'll vary that technique as I go down.
So you might hold yourself in a slip, you know, long before you touch
longer.
Down.
Longer. If I'm in a low wing airplane or an airplane that only feeds fuel from one side or the other, I'm going to try and, number one, plan enough ahead that I will be on the fuel tank that will be on the high wing. So if I'm slipping in a right crosswind and I'm holding right aileron to lower the right wing, I want to be on the left fuel tank. So as I'm slipping, that left fuel tank is higher and the fuel is now up against the fuel pickups. And so there, I can do it whenever I want. I can put that slip in wherever I want, or I can save it till a little bit later. 5 seconds, probably too late. Generally, I'm starting around out 10 seconds before I touch down in whatever aircraft I'm flying. So maybe 15 seconds prior to actual touchdown. Now, that's a very tough thing to judge, but just before I'm going for that round out, I'm going to put in that input, and I'm going to start that flare.
It also, I think that kind of situation takes a more experienced pilot because, you know, I know there are numerous times when I was flying with you where I'd think I was putting in the right, you know, corrective actions, aileron and rudder to line myself up. And I'm like, oops, nope, never mind. That crosswind's out of the right instead of the left. I'm completely wrong. And, you know, your response is always, well, just feel it. Just do what you need to do. And yes, I think that's something that comes after a long time, kind of getting used to things or not being so rusty. But sometimes it's almost rule based, right? Like if the wind is out of the left, then I'm going to be applying, you know, left aileron, and I'm going to be applying, you know, right rudder to compensate. Right. So,
yeah. Anticipate as much as you can, but react to what you see.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it aligns with what you prepared. If not, go around, come back and try it again. That's not usually a big deal. But the other thing is don't dwell on whoops. So if you've discovered that you were wrong, just make the corrective inputs and don't try to figure it out right there. Don't try to analyze the mistake right there. Save that for once you're on the ground and safe. And that's where I see people get stuck sometimes, is they make the mistake and then they sit there analyzing, well, I thought it was this and it should have been this, and we're hurtling towards the runway at 60 miles an hour. And it's like, hey, come on, keep flying the airplane. So yep. Don't get stuck on whoops.
Cool. We've got one final question, and this is from a potential student on a forum that I was watching, and he asks, or she asks, I apologize, what kind of aircraft should I learn in, a high wing or a low wing?
Yes. It's whatever you can afford, whatever's close by you, whatever the school that you are the most comfortable at is flying. And that's it. It's a comfort thing. If you're 400 pounds, you might have a hard time climbing up on the wing of a Piper Cherokee. Okay. I can't think of many other examples, but I mean,
yeah.
If you're not comfortable in your environment, you will not learn. And you will just sit there and spend money and waste time and not get it.
Yeah.
And then you'll be frustrated and you'll hate flying. We don't want you to hate flying. Nobody wants you to hate flying. So if it actually means that you need to try a place out and you're like, yeah, I'm kind of skeeved out here, I'm going to go to this other place. And you're like, oh, wow, this place is really cool. Yeah, I'm really happy here. And everybody makes me feel comfortable. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about anybody's feelings where you're leaving. You know, just go. This is not a place to be uncomfortable. This is not a time to be uncomfortable. And, you know, it's definitely something that we want people to do. We want them to do more of it, and we want them to enjoy it.
I think that's a good place to stop. You want to take us home, Rob? Good episode.
Well, hey, thanks everybody for joining us on episode 39. If you've got any kind of comments, questions, or concerns, send us an email, hello@spreadaviation.com. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. And
not Twitter.
It's not Twitter. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you could check us out there, but check us out on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for Spread Aviation. And check out our Monday night live streams on twitch.tv/spreadaviation.
All right, everybody. Take care. Fly safe.
Fly safe.